I am very proud to be joined now by Dennis Lanham. He is a veteran of the Normandy D-Day landings, and he was born in Bathford in 1924, so seeing quite a lot about life around Bath as well. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning.
How are you? How was the service this morning?
A lot better than usual. A few more people turned up.
Yeah. It's a strange time, isn't it? We'll have our Remembrance Sunday service like everybody else next on Sunday itself. And I think there will be quite a big turnout. But, of course, last year we were all dissuaded from attending. So it'll be interesting to see how many people come back. And when you go to those services, what's running through your head?
What runs through my head is just the fact I try very hard to remember how lucky I am. Extremely lucky. I have come home without my hearing, or without most of it, and I suppose that's physically that's what I lost most. But then I think, was it ever worth it sometimes? You know, it had to happen. There's no two ways about this. The war had to happen. But sometimes I think we in this country try and think that the Nazi regime was the worst in the world. But I got my doubts because my eldest brother was a prisoner of the Japs and he came home weighing 105 pounds.
So your family saw a great deal of suffering one place or another in the theatre of the war. Yes. You were born in Bathford in 1924. That was before the Queen was born, actually, wasn't it? Almost impossible for us to imagine. What was life in Bathford like growing up?
I didn't grow up in Bathford. We moved from Bathford into Bath when I was 2, 1926. We moved into number 3 Beaufort Square, which has been demolished and rebuilt. Now, I have been back to Beaufort Square not so many years ago with a camera, and I have noticed that the original stone doorstep of the side door was left in place.
So there is something as a memorial.
So there is something of old number 3. It was a pub built in 1700 and something. My father was a watchmaker and jeweller. And, of course, the war had not been over for so long. During the war, I think he drove trams. Now, why he came to Bath, I do not know, because as a child, you didn't ask questions.
So he wasn't originally from Bath?
No, I was originally Bath. Well, it's only 3 miles. Yes, it's Bath. I actually grew up in Beaufort Square.
Mm. And what was life like growing up in Bath in the 20s
tough,
and 30s?
Tough, because I knew poverty. My father was ill for a long, long time. And depression of the 1920s, who wanted watches and jewellery repaired? I do remember going with him to a place in Portland Place. They had a grandfather-type clock on a landing halfway up their stairs. In the pendulum was 1 pint of pure mercury. Now, I think that same clock could be in Sparrow's offices in Queen Square, but I'm not too sure of that statement. But they have a clock with a similar pendant. Now, I remember going with my father up to there. He also went to places in the circus in the Royal Crescent to wind their grandfather's clocks on contract. But apart from that, there was no money.
Mm. What were you doing as a teenager, as a young man, before you went into the army?
Before I went into the army, I left school as a junior clerk, actually. And I went to work for a firm of wholesale fruiters in James Street West, where Bowler's is now. They were originally called H.C. Williams, which was the name of the boss, Henry Crocker Williams, who was a very, very well-known Quaker. He then changed the name of 1950-something and made it limited to Crocker Williams Limited. Had a place in Bristol and a place in Salisbury called Lywoods. And so that's where I started. But this type of work wasn't for me. I was out in the depot, stacking this, stacking that. And whilst the firm was there, I became a lorry driver salesman. And then when that stopped, I changed completely. I didn't know what to do. I took on a job for the Shaw Company as an auditor. And there I stayed auditing books from then till I retired.
So quite a change then when you were conscripted into the army. You went in was it 1942?
I went in December 1942, 3rd of December 1942.
And what was your initial experience of life in the services?
Oh, quite a shock, I can assure you. You see, army life is 168 hours a week. You do as you're told. You do it when you're told. You're worse than convicts, really. Because, you know, prisoners in this country, they've always got a roof over their head, but not necessarily as a soldier. Many a night I had no roof over my head as a soldier. But these things go on. Something very topical are injections, are they not? Now, I can show you my old army book where I was called up on the 3rd of December, and by the 8th, I've had 5 inoculations. Now, I think I might have been able to refuse them. But remember, once you join the army, once you're called up in the army, you come under King's regulations plus civil law. I might have been able to refuse it. Now, had I refused and taken ill on the field of battle, to quote them, and could not do my duty, quite likely I'd have been shot.
Goodness. So 5 injections is a relatively painless alternative, isn't it?
And so you all line up with your arm under and you get all these jabs. You have all these jabs of tabs and tets and nothing.
So you saw the action almost straight away with 5 jabs in 5 days.
Exactly, yes. And you fire a rifle and you fire a Bren gun and you throw a grenade and you go into a gas chamber. Oh, yes.
And you were working, if I'm correct, you were working on tanks, weren't you?
After my initial training, I went on to tanks and almost explicitly on Churchill's.
And it was tanks that rather got you into trouble with D-Day in the first place, wasn't it? You were working on them.
Well, there is a story, we'll put it that way. You see, there is a story that there were some tanks down in Gosport that didn't exist. They were called crocodiles. But anyway, one of these tanks, apparently, according to the driver, was playing up. The drivers apparently found that the timing of this engine had slipped. And the reason it had slipped was the distributor was slightly slack. So the tank was retimed, but they hadn't finished by the time the landing craft started to move. You see, D-Day should have been June the 5th. So no one knew when they were going to move. And if someone said move, you moved. But these two men were still on this landing craft. It was alleged I was one of them and Johnny War was the other. But in history, it is not on record and I would...
We'll leave it that way. But where did this alleged landing craft end up?
It ended up on somewhere between the end of the Canadian landing and the Americans. The reason I say that is because this is recorded in the history of the 79th Armoured Div, that the first action of these crocodiles, which was a big flamethrower, by the way, the first action was at Carentan, you know, somewhere between these two. But who knew where they landed? Not many people. because the tide had moved them out of position. No one knew where they were landing to. And when you think back that there had been high officers who went by submarine at night with a canoe to get samples of beaches to make certain a tank could land on it. They'd not land where they wanted to. You've got to take your hat off and say, well, what a load of bodies.
So you appeared, it is alleged, on these beaches. And what are your memories of that day?
One word. Something the BBC couldn't record.
Noise.
they didn't have sound cameras. The Americans did. The Americans, I think, had 220-odd movie cameras for D-Day. I think we had just a few which could not record noise. And I am told when film of the D-Day and days after was shown on BBC, they put a piece of classical music as a background.
You didn't hear classical music, I'm sure, when you were there.
I'm sure we didn't.
What sort of noises were these?
Well, if you can imagine... you can't imagine.
I can't.
You can't imagine 10, 20 big warships in the middle of the channel firing broadsides of 12-inch shells that will fly through the air, 25, 30 mile You know, it's noise, noise, noise.
How did you get back? Because you then...
I didn't go.
No, but whoever it was that was working on...
Oh, these two lads, it is reported, went to the Beachmaster because on D-Day there was these men called Beachmasters who signaled safe places. If it wasn't safe, a flail tank would get rid of the mines and flags would go up so they had a safe passage for the tanks. Mm. They went to the Beachmaster and told them the story. And he pointed them to a landing craft that was going back to Gosport. I believe my major, who was Major Knight, I think he had them on the carpet, almost absent without leave.
Goodness, I mean,
enough said.
I think there are easier places to go for a day trip, whether it's AWOL or not, aren't there? Afterwards, you did go back to the continent, and you then took part in the remainder of the war, didn't you?
I landed in Courseulles-sur-Mer, which I believe had been freed by the Canadians, from what memory. We moved about 10, 15 miles inland, took over a farm, remember it very well, a farm with a big orchard. And, of course, this was August. And, of course, the farmer didn't want us in his orchard. And we worked and worked. We just had five tanks to start with, these crocodiles. All the rest of the battle tanks of crocodiles in manufacture had drills, holes drilled and tapped. So you've got a kit of so many boxes and a gun, and you could transform that Churchill tank into a Churchill, into a crocodile flamethrower. And by the end of the war, we had, I think, some like 200 crocodiles on the continent. That's the amount of work our unit done.
Mm. And you moved through Belgium and through the Netherlands, and you then ended up in Germany.
Yes. Yeah, my first entry into Germany was into Osnabrück. We took over a paper manufacturing factory there. Considering it had railway lines, everything had there. And I'm afraid we were rather naughty boys there, because when you make paper, you dry the pulp on nice white blanket. Well, there was no white blanket left when we left, because we had all new blankets. It was there I was instrumental with another chap, a chap named Eric Mason from Preston. We arrested the chief of the Gestapo of Osnabrück, Herr Otto Schmidt, who had hands like dinner plates. You see, the 79th Div with all these crocodiles was a division of specialised armour. We were not a fighting division. You see, this area had the 43rd Wessex Division. They fight as a unit. General Sir Brian Horrocks was the man in charge of this one. We only loaned out tanks to whoever wanted them. If someone had a rough patch and couldn't get a pillbox, they would want a crocodile, so they got one. So when the war finished, we weren't needed. But it was then realised that crocodiles, apart from being a terrible weapon, I'm not really defending them, but it did shorten the war. Mm. It did shorten the war, no doubt about it. And every general will tell you this, because the Germans would rather do this than get burnt.
Mm. So who wouldn't?
And this went on. Mm. And it was then thought that this would be the way to shorten the war in Japan. And so 50 kits to make up a Churchill into a crocodile was put aside, and a man by the name of Roy Harrison, here he is, with me. Roy Harrison and I were the two mechanics chosen to go to America, to go to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We are there in Brussels at that time.
Yes.
There's my army book mentioned I have to go to the Far East.
Yes.
But we didn't go.
You didn't go.
No, we didn't go. But
because the war came to an end. You have a fine chest of medals in front of me. I'm almost dazzled by the glisten. You keep them very, very clean by the look of it. What are they for? What are the different medals you've got there?
Well, reading from your left,
yes,
is the 1939-45 star.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is the France and Germany star.
Yes.
The big round silver one is the King George V medal. And the next one is France's highest honour, The Légion d'honneur.
That one I recognise.
Je suis un chauvet.
Dennis, we do not have an awful lot of time on this show, but I know that we're going to be talking in slower time at a later date, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing the rest of your story then. But in the meantime, thank you very much for coming in on Armistice Day. I'm delighted to hear you and hear the story, and I'm delighted to know that... you got back safely from somebody got back safely, shall we say, from a very interesting day out